Well, that's the thing. I mean, we had to learn Spanish at school with an Irish accent, didn't we? I mean, fui embarco, fui embarco. I've actually been teaching it to my nephew. I've been teaching my nephew Spanish. He's a 6-year-old nephew. It's absolutely hilarious. I like my nephew, actually. I like him. He's a good bloke. I get on with my sister's son. He's a good bloke. Is my nephew. Yeah, I like spending time with him. What? Is that how you see people? Is that how you see people? You think that it's good for me to spend time with them because it helps to indirectly pass on my genes according to J. Philippe Vashon's genetic similarity theory? Is that how you see people? Well, if that's how you see people, I mean, how can we be friends? How can we be friends? Yeah, well, we've been friends since we were 12. But I mean, if you that is such a cold way to see people. That's such a mean way to see people. That's just like, that's how like, the Nazis would have seen people. Is that honestly how you see people? Oh, I'm not a good friend. Oh, poor Ed. Poor Ed. I'm not a good friend because I don't tolerate your Nazi opinions. Oh, poor Ed. Oh, and you say you tolerate it when I get upset and have a go at you and project all my insecurities onto you and then break down. Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, sure. No, nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong with me. No, no, no. You're just being a Nazi. If you're going to be a Nazi, we can't be friends. I mean, how can we be friends? Why are we friends if you're a Nazi? I mean, you know, why? What do you mean? What do you mean my dad died recently and I've got completely conflicted emotions about him because he held the same kind of views that you hold and I can't deal with this and I'm insecure about my working class background and want to see middle class by saying all these virtue signalling things? That's absolute rubbish. That's absolute rubbish. Nothing to do with it. How can you say that? How can you bring up my dad? How can you bring my family into this? That is so mean. It's just so mean. It's so mean. How can we be friends if you... It's so... Hello, hello, hello. I thought I'd start with a bit of a true story. I used to have an extremely good friend, actually, a best friend. And our friendship broke down in very similar circumstances to what I've just described to you. And that was that basically what would happen is that we would meet up and he would eventually start questioning my morality and saying that I was far right and all this kind of thing. And then we make up, and then the evening would culminate in him crying and using me as basically free therapy for his various psychological problems. Ultimately, I got sick of this, and we stopped being friends. But it did raise a very interesting issue, because, of course, he regarded me, perhaps correctly, as being politically conservative and politically of the right, and he was most definitely politically of the left. And it was fascinating that from my perspective, I was perfectly able to tolerate the fact that he very strongly disagreed with me on certain things. But he was not able to tolerate the fact that I disagreed with him. He was not able to tolerate the fact my being different from his views was a problem, whereas his being different from my views was no problem for me. I was basically more tolerant of him. And this seems to be a general trend when people who are left-wing, or as they're known in America, liberals, come up against those who are conservative or right-wing. When I was at university, to my shame, I was known as Atheist Ed, and I would be extremely critical of the Christian Union, which was this fundamentalist Christian Union group at the university. Now, despite being a fundamentalist Christian group, and despite thinking that homosexuality was morally wrong and that non-Christians would go to hell and all this kind of thing, you had this interesting contrast, this tension, whereby they were extremely nice people. You couldn't have got kinder people at Durham University or Aberdeen University than you did among the Christian Union. And they would be perfectly tolerant of me having different views from them, of me disparaging the idea that God existed or they saying various blasphemous things about their views. They were fine with that. But the other way round, I couldn't cope with the fact that they disagreed with my views. I couldn't empathise with them, but they could empathise with me. And this is a very interesting difference. And it seems that this is the fundamental difference between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives can empathise with liberals, but liberals cannot empathise with conservatives. And this has all kinds of interesting consequences. There are fundamentally different personalities between the average conservative and the average liberal, and it brings about a situation where we are more likely to be pushed in a liberal direction. And that's what I want to look at today. It was suggested to me by one of my viewers, and that's what I want to look at today. Political differences in personality. Now, what used to be argued was that it was ultimately reducible down to the so-called Big Five personality traits. What the Big Five personality traits are is that you get a load of different sort of minor, a bit like intelligence and G, you get a load of sort of very minor distinct things like orderliness and compassion and whatever, and you see how, and you factor analyze them, and you divide them into five key factors. These are the Big Five: extroversion, neuroticism, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and openness. And you look at what they predict. But the fundament, and what was basically argued in the past, was that openness was the key factor. People that were liberal were tended to be higher in openness to new ideas and that kind of thing. And people that were conservative tended to be lower in openness and higher in conscientiousness. The fundamental problem with this is, first of all, that openness by definition seems to involve having liberal political opinions. That's one of the facets of openness. So it's basically meaningless to use openness. Of course it's going to correlate with being liberal. What else would it correlate with? It is part of openness. And secondly, the other measures didn't seem to explain this. And thirdly, there were very weak correlations. So, for example, the right-wing authoritarian scale, which is a way of measuring how right-wing you are, seems to correlate with conscientiousness at -0.15. Very, very small relationships. And so it was considered that this is not a very good way of doing it. Now, more recently, a very interesting researcher called Jonathan Haidt, who gets away with this kind of thing because he's a self-confessed liberal, which is quite interesting, presented what he called moral foundation theory. And he argued that people's political views can ultimately be reduced down to, if you like, their own Big Five. The Big Five, traditional Big Five, only goes so far. Their own Big Five. And these are: 1, care for others versus do no harm. 2, fairness, justice and equality. 3, in-group loyalty. 4, respect for authority. And 5, essentially kind of purity. Pure. Now, these five, he argued, people vary on these, and it is this that helps to predict the political orientation they are likely to adopt. And what he found is that although we all have these Big Five foundations, liberals will tend to value the first two. So people who are liberal will tend to value care for others and fairness, justice and equality. Whereas people who are conservatives will tend to value the latter three: in-group loyalty, respect for authority and purity. Purity being why they would be opposed to perhaps things like homosexuality or sexual deviance or people or transsexuality or whatever. Those people are more diverse in a sense. I mean, they actually value all the Big Five. These five, whereas liberals basically hardly value in-group loyalty, respect for authority or purity at all. And they very, very strongly value the first two. So you can see this fundamental difference. The conservatives are more complex. The conservatives have five moral foundations, whereas there is an extent to which the liberals only have two, or they have the other three to a very, very limited extent. Now, a second argument was what was known by someone called de Jong and various others, and he argued that there are two dimensions to understanding the political perspective that people come from. The first is traditionalism, and the second is basically egalitarianism. So if you just say, well, if you reduce political conservatism to being traditionalist, then this may explain why political conservatives don't like change and, you know, like old-fashioned things and are very polite and whatever. But it doesn't explain why they tend to favour logic and order and reason as against sort of compassion and egalitarianism. It doesn't explain that. And equally, if you reduce it down, political conservatism and liberalism, to attitudes towards equality, well, that doesn't explain why conservatives would be more polite than liberals and less inclined to swear. You have to. So therefore, he argues there are two dimensions: traditionalism and anti-egalitarianism. And conservatism involves being traditionalist and anti-egalitarian, i.e. wanting order and hierarchy and a bit like an army, really. That sort of thing. Now, but what we end up with, either way, is a very interesting situation, which is that you have two groups that are going to see the world in quite a different way. And what that would perhaps predict is that they would be quite cynical of each other. They would doubt each other's morality. They would see one would see the other as immoral. One would see the other as a problem because, from a conservative perspective, the people who are liberals are disloyal. They have no respect for authority, and they're kind of disgusting, and they do disgusting things that we instinctively kind of feel are disgusting. And from the perspective of liberals, conservatives are just nasty people. They're just nasty people. They don't care about other people. They don't care about fairness and justice. They're unpleasant people. So you can see how there's going to be this very, very fundamental conflict between the liberals, who are kind of like individualists, really, and the conservatives, who are more kind of group-oriented. So you've got this very, very interesting difference. They can't see things from each other's perspective. Now, again, I return to that idea. We've discussed before the concept of group selection and individual selection. Individual selection is that you pass, you know, you act to pass on your own genes. You act in your own genetic interests. Group selection will tend to involve indirectly passing on your genes. So you can pass on your genes by investing in your kin, that kind of thing, extended in that way, not your children, but your kin. And you can pass on your genes by investing in your extended phenotype, i.e. in your ethnic group. Now, if you do something like sacrifice your life for the good of your group, there's a degree to which you are helping your group to pass on more of its genes by defending it against being invaded or whatever it happens to be. And this means that you are highly group selected. Now, you're going to get differences in how group selected an organization is. And we've got evidence from computer models, as I've stressed again and again and again, that the more group selected it is, i.e. the more internally cooperative the group is and the more externally hostile the group is, the more high in positive and negative ethnocentrism the group is, the higher are the percentage of optimum percentage of the group who are prepared to literally sacrifice their lives for their group and be group selected, the more dominant the group tends to be. All else being equal, the more ethnocentric group, the more group-selected group tends to dominate. And so you can see this tension, which is that the liberals, they are individualistic. They, if you like, are down at a simpler level of selection. The level of selection of you know, individual animals, you know, frogs or whatever, where there's no group. No tightly bonded group, whereas the conservatives are the group selected ones. Now, on this basis, of course, we know from research by my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee, and you can look at this in our book At Our Wit's End, that we were clearly under pressure for group selection until relatively recently. They were under Darwinian selection until about 1800, and this meant that there were different groups fighting each other, and the more group-selected group tended to dominate. And the Europeans were highly, highly, highly group-selected, and because they were highly group-selected, they produced lots of geniuses. These geniuses tended not to have their own children. They tended to basically sacrifice their own fertility for the good of the group. And you had all of these people like General Gordon or whatever, who would sacrifice themselves for the good of the group. That's what we were selected for, group selection. With the collapse of Darwinian selection due to the Industrial Revolution and the consequent improvement in health, the consequent improvement in inoculations, the consequent improvement in cheapening of the price of food and all this kind of thing, and lowering child mortality from 40% down to 1%, obviously what you've got is a collapse in group selection. All of these genes, all of these children who would have been born with mutant genes in 1800 would almost be problematic genes of the body, such as a poor immune system, they would have been killed. They would have died as children. And as we've discussed elsewhere, we know that these genes of mutant genes of the body tend to correlate with mutant genes of the mind, because the mind is about 88% of the genome. And so what this means is that if you've got a problem with the body, you're probably going to have a problem with the mind. And we know this is the case because we know that, for example, paedophilia correlates with attached earlobes and minor physical abnormalities, autism correlates with all kinds of minor physical abnormalities in the face, and all this kind of thing. And so, as my colleague Michael Woodley has argued, you're going to get a rise in spiteful mutations. You're going to get a rise in things that would have been selected out under conditions of Darwinian selection. And more and more and more of these mutants, basically, are going to pass on their genes. They're going to have children and grandchildren and so on. Now, in that we were highly group selected, what you would, of course, predict is that there would be a proliferation of individualistic genes. And of course, this is exactly what you see. We've got society is becoming more and more and more individualistic. And as this happens, these mutants, these spiteful mutants, can get into positions of power, and then they can undermine structures that society has developed, which elevate group selection. An example of this, of course, is religiousness. Religiousness tends to elevate group selection. It tends to take things which are evolutionarily adaptive in terms of creating a group that's going to be successful. You can see this in the Old Testament. I mean, it's basically high in positive and negative ethnocentrism, self-sacrificial for the group, and so on. Take those institutions and undermine them. And this seems to have been what's happened. As my colleague has demonstrated, until the 1960s, there was no relationship at all between paternal age, and paternal age is a marker for mutation, because the older your father is, the more likely you are, the more likely he is to have defective semen, the more likely he is to have mutant genes, the more likely you are to be autistic, and the more autistic you are, the more likely you are not to be religious. Because also autism is negatively associated with religiousness for reasons I've looked at elsewhere, because autistics can't empathise very well, and that they can't see signals of an underlying mind, and therefore they can't see signal in a face, let's say, and they can't see signals underlying mind, therefore, in the world, and so they tend not to believe in God. So what you get is a situation where it seems that religiousness was holding back this kind of tsunami of mutation. And in the 60s, sex came rather late for me in 1963, somewhere between the end of the Chatterley Band, the Beatles' first LP. In the 60s, when all their lot went down the long slide, in the words of Philip Larkin, then religiousness was finally undermined by this buildup of spiteful mutants. And it opened up this tsunami of mutation, and suddenly there was a relationship between paternal age and atheism. The older your father was, the more inclined you were to be an atheist and to not go to church, as my colleague has shown. So this demonstrates what has happened. There has been this build-up of basically individualistic genes explaining why we are becoming more individualistic and less group selective. So and you also get the interesting point that the liberals cannot see things from a conservative perspective, but the conservatives can see things from a liberal perspective. And this is particularly fascinating. So we've got these five moral foundations. The liberals very strongly emphasise the first two. The conservatives emphasise the other three more than the first two, but they still do have more of an input into the first two. And so they can see how the liberal thinks. They can empathise with the liberal. They can agree with the liberal. They can tolerate the liberal. A bit like me and my friend, or the Christian Union and me. They can tolerate them. They can be friends with them. It's fine. Whereas it's very difficult the other way round. And you'll notice on Twitter, for example, this woman Angela Saley in her book Superior, she seems to have gone back onto Twitter and preemptively blocked pretty much anyone that might possibly disagree with her. Numerous academics, any academic of any significance who's written anything important on the issue of race, myself, Nathan Kofness, Davide Piffer, the list goes on, have all been blocked by her. She wants no desire to engage with them or debate with them because she basically sees them as evil. She can't empathise with them in any way. They're just bad people. So what, block them for God's sake, or they could pollute my mind with their evil Nazi way of thinking. Whereas it doesn't work the other way round. You'll notice on Facebook that the people who are more conservative are more happy to just debate with those with whom they disagree and and not block them. So you get this difference, anyway, this breakdown of group selection between the two groups. This is what it seems to ultimately be about. J.S. Sinn has argued the individualists are individually selected, and the liberals, and the conservatives are more group selective. In terms of who's inclined towards being a liberal, it's what's known as the weird people who are Western, educated, industrial, rich, democratic. Now, this is interesting because these people will tend to be low in stress. If you're low in stress, it tends to make you kind of low in certain evolved instincts. And so if we've been evolved to be highly group selected and self-sacrificial, then you might expect them to perhaps be low in that. But also it might imply that those people are carrying more in the way of mutant genes, because, of course, the collapse in child mortality would have happened among the upper classes, the higher classes first. Socioeconomic status seems to be, according to research in The Sun Also Rises, about 70% genetic across generations. And so consequently, you're going to get more mutants, more of these mutants among Western educated, wealthy people in democratic countries because they've been under purifying Darwinian selection for less time. And you will find fewer of them among the working class or among people who are non-Western or whatever. So that would seem to make sense. Very interesting study by Graham on moral stereotyping. It was called Moral Stereotyping in Liberalism and Conservatism by Jess Graham et al. And it asked people to answer questions who are liberal from the perspective of a conservative, to try and empathise with them, and vice versa. It asked conservatives to answer questions from the perspective of the liberal. Now, what it found was that both groups exaggerated the moral difference of the other group. So, therefore, both groups saw the other group as more different from it and more, if you like, evil than it actually in reality was. However, the liberals were the least empirically accurate, i.e. they saw conservatives as much more nasty and bad and different from them than they were. Whereas the conservatives saw liberals as a little bit wrong, a little bit more different and less moral or whatever than them than they actually were. And so what this shows again and again and again is you end up in a situation where conservatives, which is going to be like a lot of the people I think watching this, conservatives can tolerate liberals, can empathise with liberals, can understand liberals, can be friends with liberals, can get on with liberals, but it doesn't work the other way round. And so in terms of political discourse, what you would expect is for the conservatives to always lose ground against the liberal. If the liberal presents an argument about abortion being a woman's right or whatever, the conservative, because he has some degree of care for others and fairness and justice and equality, will be able to be persuaded round to that point of view. But it will be very difficult for the liberal to be persuaded around to a point of view that it should be higher in in-group ethnic loyalty, respect for authority, or understanding the importance of purity and behaving in a manner that's not degenerate because it's good for the group. And so therefore things will tend to get pushed once Darwinian selection is taken away in an increasingly more liberal direction. And you would predict that would keep happening until it got to a point where it caused the normal structures and so on of society to basically break down, where things degenerated essentially into war and fighting and violence. And of course, when that happened, then people would become more, A, would be selected to be more group selected, but also people would tend to become higher in stress, and because they'd be higher in stress, they would be higher in religiousness, and religiousness tends to elevate group selected ideas and so on as the will of God, and so therefore it makes people more group selected, it makes people more ethnocentric, and then you end up basically with a backlash. So you would predict a system whereby, because of the way in which conservatives empathise with liberals, but liberals will not empathise, cannot empathise to the same extent with conservatives, that we would become ever more liberal until a tipping point was reached, until things got so bad, people were so stressed, things were so awful, things were so terrible, change was so fast, everything was that there would be then this natural ethnocentric reaction brought about particularly by a combination of stress mediated by religion, elevating ethnocentrism. And there is a degree to which perhaps that is what is happening. This process is now occurring, which is why these kinds of discussions would have been unthinkable 20 years ago when I was at university, but equally 20 years ago when I was at university, all this transsexuals' rights and mass was also unthinkable. But it's been pushed in this ever more liberal direction. So this seems to me to be reasonably sum up the difference between the two groups. And so when on Twitter you will notice, and it's been observed only today on Twitter, and I've been there, that these people getting blocked by people like Angela Saini or whatever, that they can't tolerate difference, they can't tolerate people disagreeing with them, and they see everything in moral terms. So if they're criticised, it will be, oh, how can these people be so mean? How can they be so mean as to criticise this wonderful book by this wonderful woman? How can they be so mean? Because that's what they're obsessed with. They're obsessed with it. And how can they be so mean as privileged white people to criticise an Asian? That's what they're obsessed with. They're obsessed with caring for others, kindness and justice and fairness and equality. And the idea of authority, of hierarchy, of purity, and perhaps you could argue an element of truth is purity. There is a pureness to truth There is a black and white element to objective truth. There's a pureness, and conservatives like truth because it's pure, whereas lies and contradictions or whatever are impure. Those things aren't really important to them. Indeed, they reduce truth down to power. For them, it's all about fairness and equality and justice. The purity of truth doesn't really enter into it. And that is ultimately why I think I fell out with this friend of mine. It's ultimately why other people that will be watching this will fall out with friends of theirs. It's why you will find your views misrepresented by the left, because they get it wrong. They see you as more immoral by their judgment than you are. And so if you were to say, oh, it's a terrible thing that all these people from Pakistan who are very clever are coming to the West because it's reducing the IQ of Pakistan and it will make Pakistan chaotic, they interpret that, as Angela Saini did in her book, as saying, oh, you're dismissing everybody in Pakistan as stupid. Well, of course, you're saying no such thing. But they get it wrong. They get it wrong. And so it raises the question of what we, as people who are not even conservative, but simply people that believe in the importance of truth, which seems to be by definition conservative these days, should do. Should we try and empathise less? What are we supposed to do? Because we're in this difficult situation where we're group selected. We're the ones that would have survived under recent evolutionary pressures. They're not. They're the mutants that wouldn't have survived. They're proliferating, although they do breed less than the more group-selected people because they're so selfish that they're so individualistic they don't even want to bother investing their energies in children. So they tend not to breed, which is perhaps a positive thing. So what we will expect eventually is a backlash whereby a tipping point will be reached whereby it's the more group-selected people, the more K people, that's who we know, and the more religious people, and the lower IQ people, i.e. the people that don't hold the lower socioeconomic status people, that's who's breeding. And so it's inevitable that there's going to, as well as because of the stress that these policies cause, it's inevitable that there's going to be a move back. Eventually the magnitude of the breeding propensity of group selected people, both group selected at the level of personality and at the level of social class, those people that will outweigh the power of the large number of mutant individualists that are born, and it will push things in a different direction. But anyway, at the moment, I think it's an interesting issue, and I'd like to thank the person that suggested I do a video on this. It's a bit very interesting to think about. All right, well, I hope this has been of interest, and if you've enjoyed it, then please drop me a few guineas on Subscribestar or Patreon, or preferably PayPal, because I don't have to pay fees for that. And you'd be interested to get my book, Race, Difference, and Ethnocentrism. And if I forgot to say hello, 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 then hello, hello, hello. I can't remember whether I said it, but I always try to, as you know. And I hope you've enjoyed this, and do apply it in Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Look into your liberal friends and see how this operates, because it's a very interesting thing that can be looked at the personal level, and let me know what you think. And I hope that's been of interest, and goodbye.